This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. In 1969, the year after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis, the Unity Group was formed here in Chattanooga. Over the decades, the group's activists have pushed for black candidates to win local elected office in this city and in Hamilton County, advocated for a national holiday for Dr. King, and more. This year, because of the pandemic, the group has shifted to virtual for its annual King Week events, from last night's event with the Tennessee Poor People's Campaign through its march next Monday. Reverend Charlotte S.N.N. Williams is vice chairperson of the Unity Group of Chattanooga, and Eric Atkins is corresponding secretary. Reverend Williams, Eric, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us. We are humbled to be here.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
The theme for this year's Martin Luther King Jr. Week and March, which is now virtual, the theme is Just Keep Moving.
Oh, absolutely.
Tell us more about that.
Well, that's very appropriate, given the climate that we're in. We're seeing, if we take a pause, we're seeing the climate in not just in here in Chattanooga, but throughout the nation, and how we definitely have to take pause and see that we have to keep moving, because if we stop and if we drop our hats where we are, then we will not be able to, come with the time of seeing what will be deemed as something our children would not be able to pick up. What I mean by that is that we've got to keep moving, because we've got to ensure that our future generations will not have to fight the same battles that we're having to fight, that we're going to have to keep moving in order to make a way, not just for ourselves, but for the future generations, because they're counting on us. The eyes of the future are looking back at us. That's one of the reasons why we chose this theme.
It was in 1967, I do believe, Dr. King was addressing a group of young students up in Cleveland. He was giving them a blueprint for the future. And one of his famous quotes from that was, if you can't fly, then you run. If you can't run, then you walk. If you can't walk, then you crawl. But whatever you do, you have to keep moving. And that's sort of what our theme derives from. And that's what we say to the people today, especially in this climate. If you can't fly, then you run. If you can't run, then you walk. If you can't walk, then you crawl. But whatever we do, we must keep moving. We must keep moving forward for human rights and for voting rights and for women's rights and for prison abolition and for overall justice in America. That is what we are based on. That is what we are firmly rooted in this country, is the whole concept of liberty, freedom, and justice for all. So that's sort of where our thing comes from.
And another thing that he told those students back in 1967, develop within ourselves a deep sense of somebody-ness.
Isn't that a great quote, Ray? I think Dr. King sort of made up his own word there, but it does fit, because everybody has a somebody-ness. And what that means is that I matter, you matter, everybody around us matters. And that's what Dr. King was talking about in another speech when he said that we are locked in a network of mutuality. We all are put on this world, and what we are put here for is to help one another advance forward. So it's too much greed and too much selfishness and too much evil permeating in the world right now. The way that this country and society advances is that we work together, we love together, we stand together, we fight together. And so America, when we come together and we lock hands together, we are one of the mightiest nations on earth. Too much division right now.
As well as the somebody-ness speaks to the humanity in all of us. And I think that is so important even today, and how it will be more important moving forward, is that we have this hierarchy of placing people on a hierarchical landscape of seeing who is higher than someone else. And what Dr. King is reminding all of us, no, we're all on an equal playing field, and that there is humanity in all of us, and there's no big I's and little U's, that all of us are precious. All of us have a right. All of us should have this sense of knowing that what hurts you hurts me. And Dr. King was very poignant in saying that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, and that your hurts are my hurts, your gains are my gains. And so what we're seeing today is that we have to get back to the prophetic voice of Dr. King.
When he was going to accept the Nobel Peace Prize, he was looking out on the airplane and he saw that there was men out working to get the airplane clean up from the thaw and from the frost and to refuel it and to clean up all the oil. And he called these people of the ground crew. And so even the least among these, whether they are a maid, whether they are the ones who sweep the streets, whether the garbage workers, whether they are teachers, even the least of these has a role and matters. We all matter.
Another thing that he told those students back in 1967, make constructive use of the freedom you already possess.
Well, that still speaks to today as well, that because the freedoms that Dr. King tried to gain back in 67, because he was taken from us through murder in 1968, we see that there's a rollback on that, that the gains that we thought we have, that it's like we're treading old paths again, or having to retrace those steps again, because those gains are being rolled back. And that is through, quote unquote, voter suppression. That is very prevalent. You're seeing even today in the climate, whereas when the people stood up and the people got out a right to get out to vote and they made their voices heard, they made their presence known. And then all of a sudden, we're seeing that there was a narrative, a false narrative, that has come out and saying no, that the election was stolen from Donald Trump. And so you're seeing this big crisis is going on. And so those gains, what Dr. King was talking about, hold on to what you have, is the reason why we have to come together as a nation and say, no, we will not go back. We will not turn the clock back and start this injustice all over again. And we cannot allow ourselves to be at a place and a time where we're seeing that the gains that Dr. King and so many others sacrificed and literally gave their life for is now going to be taken away from us. And so that's the reason why the celebration of Dr. King is so relevant even today, given Dr. King and all of those unnamed heroes and sheroes is calling upon us to move forward.
Oh, I agree. I totally agree. And you have so many challenges that's facing the country right now and our society. Even if you look at the homeless, I was riding down Rossville Boulevard a couple of weeks ago, and I looked over into the woods and I saw tent cities being pitched up. And you would see elderly people and children sleeping on the cold leaves outside. Nothing but a kettle to warm them. Somebody's homeless today. Somebody's hurting today. Somebody needs help today. And we ought to have the capacity within ourselves. Dr. King said that the strongest force in the universe is love. And we should be loving one another more. And if we just took that advice and those principles, then the world would be a better place.
You're focusing on the values that he espoused, freedom, human dignity. When we talk about the constructive use of freedom we already possess, there's a difference between that versus what he might call, what you might call, the destructive use of freedom, the abuse of freedom. And that brings us to what we saw at the Capitol last week in Washington.
He also stood for nonviolence. He was an ardent believer in nonviolence, even when segments of the community were urging him to go more violent and more hostile. Dr. King always stood for the principles of nonviolence. And what we saw at the Capitol was an outgrowth of that. That's why Dr. King said that anger begets anger, hate begets hate, malice begets malice. And sort of, you know, I love Star Wars. And so, and Yoda would say the dark side of the Force. And so when we give into those things, we give into the dark side of the Force.
As well as, you know, when you talk about freedom, we know that we're in the midst of a pandemic, COVID-19, but for us, the African-American community or American Africans, we say COVID-16-19. Reason that being said, when you talk about freedom, is the freedom that we have never truly, truly had. And that's the reason why we're still struggling for freedom today. When Dr. King was among us, we are giving him his glories now, but Dr. King was labeled as a militant and a radical during his time. He was seen as a troublemaker during his time. And so he was jailed at least 25 to 35 times. And so we believe that Dr. King will be speaking out about the prison industrial complex. We don't say mass criminalization because when you say, or mass incarceration, because when you say that, then they say, okay, we'll just reduce that. And then you have decarceration. That is the ankle monitors and the house arrests and things of that nature. So we say there needs to be a reduction in mass criminalization. And in the midst of this pandemic, when we have been told that in order to reduce the numbers that you need to social distance, you need to have hand sanitizer, and you need to wear your mask. Well, those that are incarcerated, they're not able to do any of those things. And so even this summer, we was calling for decarceration so that those numbers in those cells would not arise. And yet they fell upon deaf ears. And so we're seeing the numbers rising in the prisons. And we live in a country that espouses freedom. However, you have persons that if they're unable to pay their bail fund, just arrested, not whether or not they're guilty or not guilty, just posting bail is something that the average American don't have an extra $250 or $500 to post bail. So we live in a country where that people shouldn't be in jail just because they can't pay bail. And so these are the freedoms that Dr. King would probably be speaking of. Even today, of seeing how America is the biggest industrialized country in the world that incarcerates its people, its own citizens.
Tell us more about the events of this week.
Tuesday night will be an educational forum. We take Wednesday off because we all tradition a day for them, so we take that off. Thursday, Brother Kevin Muhammad will be talking about, let me get my list here.
Politics with economics is symbols without substance. And what we're meaning by that, you know, like during this summer, you know, we took down the Confederate statues. We took down some of the Confederate flags. Those were symbols without substance because we're seeing that those cops that killed Breonna Taylor still have not been arrested or fired. Friday, January the 15th at 7:00 p.m., we will have Caleb, Economic Mobility Task Force, to talk to us about tax breaks and transparency and public accountability right here in Hamilton County. Then on Saturday morning at 10:00 a.m., which is January the 16th, we will continue to host our annual prayer breakfast. And the theme for the prayer breakfast will be praise through the pandemic. And that will be Pastor Timothy Carruthers of the Westside Baptist Church. That will be our keynote speaker. And then later on Saturday, the 16th at 6:00 p.m., we will have the Community Control Now Coalition to remind us that the fight still continues. And then on Sunday, January the 17th at 5:00 p.m., we'll host what is the synonym for GUN, God, Universe, and Nature, Reimagining Dr. King's Dream. And again, just speaking about the prison and pandemic that we have right here. And then on Monday, January the 18th at 5:00 p.m., our keynote speaker will be Dr. Ken Chilton, that will give us, I guess, a report on how we are as a city and as a county and the gangs that we have, for especially with you're talking about the two Chattanoogas. I guess he will pick up on when he first gave us our report, Inequality, the New Norm. So he will pick up all of this. And so what all of these presentations during this week is basically, what would Dr. King be speaking about in 2021? And these are very relevant issues that must be addressed. And not only that, we're not just going to lay out what the problems are, but provide solutions. And these solutions will lead us towards healing, uniting, and loving one another and seeing the humanity in all of us.
Dr. King himself was a martyr of gun violence. So we have to remember that. He was stricken to us on that day in April. And I think it's 52 years ago, 53 years ago now. And so Dr. King himself was a martyr of gun violence. Too many guns are in the country. We know that 35,000 people a year die because of gun violence, and the majority of those are suicides. And we still have done nothing on proliferation of all these guns. 400 million guns are on the streets of America today. And so I know a lot of the young people were pushing for common sense measures like an end to assault weapons and bump stocks and a universal background checks. Most of us are believers in the Second Amendment. But with that said, there are some common sense measures that we could begin to reduce this. And by the way, reducing the level of violence in our community is just one of those.
And where can people go online for more information?
You can go to the Unity Group's Facebook page. We have been sending out Zoom links, and we've been doing out a lot of public outreach through emails. And so those are the three ways: our Facebook page, the Zoom links we send out, and the public announcements. And you can email us at unitygroupchat02@gmail.com for more information.
All right. Reverend Williams, Eric, thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
Have a good day.
Rob Simbeck is one of the most widely read naturalists here in the Southeast. Back in the fall, I caught up with a Nashville-based author about his latest book, The Southern Wildlife Watcher, Notes of a Naturalist. He tells the stories of three dozen creatures, common and not so common, all around us, from the hummingbird and the bald eagle to the bullfrog and the bobcat. Rob, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
How did you come up with the idea for this book?
I have been an outdoor writer since I met my better half, Debbie. She knew every bird, tree, and rock in the woods. And when we were dating early on, of course, I was following her around. I started taking notes and started writing pieces that got published. And I thought, let's hang on to this part of the career and this woman. And so I wrote for a lot of state wildlife magazines, one of them being South Carolina Wildlife. And an editor there in the 90s asked me to do a column, which would just be one critter piece per issue. I did them for 25 years. And this is kind of the best of those, updated and expanded to the entire Southeast.
And these critters, we are talking 36 animals in this book, 36 critters, 12 land, 12 water, 12 in the air.
Yes. And one of the things I hope makes this book different is that, yes, we do some things like the bald eagle and the bobcat, but we also do the housefly and the earthworm. You don't know what you're going to get going from one chapter to the next. I think everything is pretty much created equal. I find them all interesting, and so they all show up in the book.
And you can read it from start to finish as a book, but it can also be a reference guide.
Exactly. It is perfect for skipping around. My introduction sort of sets everything in place. And my old friend Jim Cassada did a foreword that is much more literary than the book itself. Basically, any book like this is, hey, guess what I saw? And so this is me telling a story about each creature, just something from my life, something that fascinates me, and then pulling in an expert or two to make sure I've got it locked down on worthwhile information.
Tell us the story of the hummingbird.
The hummingbird is my favorite piece in the book, and it scored me a lot of brownie points here. I'll read just a little bit so people can get an idea for how this book works. And this is the ruby-throated hummingbird chapter, just a little bit of the opening. "Sit here on the porch," Debbie said one Sunday afternoon in early summer. "I want to show you my hummingbirds." We had just started dating, and I had come to visit her at her little white house in the country. She picked up something that looked like an hourglass with several tiny red saxophones sticking out the bottom. I soon learned it was a hummingbird feeder, but my knowledge of flora, fauna, and their associated hardware was so rudimentary at the time that I had no idea. She walked a few paces into the yard and stood holding the gadget about a foot in front of her face, which wore a look of determined expectation. She stood this way for several minutes, her arm crooked at a 45-degree angle, until I began to believe the hummingbirds might be imaginary and that I should think about tiptoeing toward my car. Soon, though, something that sounded like a tiny atomic cat purring zipped across my field of vision. It stopped a few feet from her and the feeder, hanging in midair like a battery-operated Christmas ornament, its body angled kind of like the Concorde. It eyed her, eyed the feeder, and moved in for a drink. Debbie lit up like she'd just been named Miss America, and I have to admit, I was pretty impressed too.
How does it come to you? Is there a phrase or an image, and then everything else follows around it?
When I do a piece like this, which is probably my favorite kind of thing to do, a short essay on a single topic, I take everything that I know about it and just sit with it and type random notes. If it's something like the crayfish, where I remember catching them as a kid, and we'd bring them home in a bucket and put them in a big wash tub and just look at them. And one day, one of them was obviously giving birth. It was the first birds and bees thing I ever had. So I'll take anything like that pops into my head. And then I will go to my library at home, which is pretty extensive, and the internet, and just cruise around and look for interesting stuff that I don't know. And for an expert or two, in this case, from the Southeast, who I think might be simpatico, somebody I'd like to talk to about this critter. And I assemble all this stuff. It's huge, the amount of information that I try to pull together. And then I just pick the best stuff and throw the rest away.
And then how do you keep it all in balance between what you're seeing and sharing in what you're seeing, and then that expert that you find?
I will show the expert his or her quotes in context to make sure I've got them right and talk through what impresses me about the creature. And I make sure that the balance is one of those, it's when you cook without a recipe is all it is. Does this feel right? And I've been writing since I was a teenager and I'm in my 60s now. So I've got a pretty good feel for what interests me enough to stay in a piece. And then all I've got to fool is the editor. It's the editor's job to bring in readers. It's mine to fool him or her.
Tell us another story. And I'm thinking now about the cottontail rabbits.
With the rabbit, and I'll do the best way to tell that story is just to read a little bit of the opening. And what I hope, and I've got friends who are longtime outdoor writers, and what I'm aiming at is for them to say, you know, I've been a fan of or a hunter of or whatever it is of this critter all my life. And there were some things I didn't know that you pointed out. So here's just a little of the opening of the Eastern Cottontail Rabbit. You've got to hand it to the rabbit. Few creatures have cut a wider swath through literature and culture than this meek, furry symbol of the reproductive arts. That connection has given us both the Easter Bunny and the Playboy Bunny. And the scope of the creature's wider influence can be seen in just a short list of its representatives in the culture. Thumper and Bugs, Brer Roger and Peter Rabbit, Alice in Wonderland's White Rabbit, and Jefferson Airplane's psychedelic nod to it, the Velveteen Rabbit, Captain Kangaroo's Bunny Rabbit, and the Hare, different genus, same family, who gets smoked by the tortoise. What's not to love, right? Rabbits are docile, they're soft, and they have floppy ears and cottony tails. Despite all that, rabbits have been known to stir negative emotions ranging from mild to homicidal. Ask any gardener. Better yet, ask the Aussies. Australia, whose evolutionary path branched off pretty quickly from the rest of the world, has provided us with the quintessential be careful what you let loose story, and it involves the lowly rabbit. And I go on from there. The year that Darwin published The Origin of Species, a farmer in Australia brought in 24 rabbits from Europe as something to hunt on his big spread out there. Within a decade, hunters were taking 2 million a year and not putting a dent in the population. There was nothing that fed on them. They loved the vegetation. They were basically allowed to run free by nature, and they quickly regretted the fact that this guy did that.
Who would have thought?
Yeah. You know, the thing about nature is that there's nothing really peaceful about it unless you're sitting on the deck for 20 minutes at sundown. It's tooth and claw, and you'd better have something that eats the thing that eats you, or there are going to be enough of those to make you disappear. There's a feedback loop that goes into nature. And I think one of the things I want to get across in this book is that appreciation should lead to responsibility. Just things like make sure you clean your bird feeders because birds do spread diseases. Make sure you understand the role of humans in dealing with and sometimes determining the extent of the populations of creatures that no longer have creatures that eat them.
What's something that most people might not realize about what it takes to write about nature, write about the outdoors, or maybe a misperception people have about that?
The beautiful thing about being a freelance writer like I am is you don't have to know anything. You have to find people who do know something and put together what they say well. And the trick is you don't have to be as much of an expert as people think you are. I do rely on the experts because I'm not one. And I still consider myself a general assignment reporter as I was in my first job out of college at a daily newspaper. I write about almost everything, and you can't know very much about most things. And so It's a class for me. Writing about nature, like writing about anything else, is taking what I do know, using that to structure questions and areas of research. And then the only way to become a pretty good writer is to do it day in and day out. When people say they'd like to do it, I say, well, you just have to tie your butt to the chair for quite a few hours a day for quite a few years, and then you have a chance of going after. So there's nothing very glamorous about it. But the good thing is that writing about nature, research for me is a walk in the woods sometimes. It helps me think. It helps me clear away distractions. If I've got an animal that I'm just not sure where to go with it, just watching other animals in action in the woods or just enjoying a tree swaying in the wind might give me the little hook I need.
Which writers of the outdoors, writers of nature may come to mind as you are working on something like this?
Well, the people like Burroughs, I'm a big fan of Roger Torrey Peterson, who put together the field guides and the work that he did, but Muir and Audubon, the classics, the people that we all know. And I like the early outdoor pieces of Hemingway, and it's a different kind of nature writing, but it was obviously someone who knew and cared what it was like to sit at a camp beside a creek. And what you heard and saw as the sun went down and you were cooking a fish you'd just caught. So all of those places.
What's next?
I've got an agent pitching a children's book right now. And I am putting together a book of the poetry of a friend of mine who died very young, whose poetry I think deserves a wider audience. I retired from the music part of my writing career, which I did a lot of work for a radio show that counted down the top 40 country hits every week. Enjoyable. So that opened up some space. And right now I am enjoying the space. We do live in the country, take a lot of long walks. I spend a lot of time on the deck. And right now it's about telling people about this book and doing what every writer does, hoping that one person at a time thinks, you know, that Simbeck book called The Southern Wildlife Watcher may have something interesting for me.
And where can people go online for more information about the book?
My website is robsimbeck.com, and the publisher is the University of South Carolina Press. Either one will lead you in the right direction. Or you can just look for the Southern Wildlife Watcher, Rob Simbeck, online, and somebody will show up.
All right. Rob, thanks so much.
Ray, I appreciate it a lot.
Keep up on the latest in Washington from NPR anytime online on our website, WUTC.org. You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment. This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. A climber here in Chattanooga hopes to help create a Black-led guide service as one way to make the sport more diverse. Heath Rowland at Ground Up Sales works with climbing brands throughout the industry and outdoor retailers here in the Southeast. Before the holidays, I spoke with him and Brandon Belcher, a climber based in Atlanta, whose own story inspired Heath to take action.
Brandon, Heath, thanks for joining us.
Ah, hey, what's going on? Thanks for having me.
This all began with one of you hearing the other on a podcast.
I had heard Brandon's podcast with Kathy, which Brandon and I had had some short interactions, but he knows my coworker a lot better. But Brandon and I don't know each other super well. Was listening to Kathy Carlo's podcast for the love of climbing. And wanted to listen to Brandon's episode, mostly because of the content, but also to kind of get to know Brandon a little better. He's part of our athlete team and things like that, and just kind of wanted to hear his message. And got a lesson, man. Got some really good lessons from it, actually. Kind of prompted the course of action, which is kind of put together this guide service.
And what were some of the things you shared, Brandon, that people who may not have heard that podcast and might be hearing both of you for the first time?
Mostly just highlighting my general experiences as a Black climber in the southeastern portion of the United States. I think there are some unique, I won't say barriers, but there are some unique challenges that some of us have to kind of deal with on a day-to-day basis, or at least when we're going out to the climbing areas that we want to access, that some people just didn't necessarily think about. Yeah, it was mostly just kind of sharing my experiences and my perspective on a few of the things that we as Black climbers have to kind of deal with in these predominantly rural conservative areas that we are wanting to recreate in.
Such as, and this was mentioned in the Times Free Press article, such as seeing Confederate flags on the way to Soddy Daisy.
That's one part of it. Another example, kind of growing up in a popular area called Rocktown in North Georgia, and you're seeing kind of apartheid era, like, symbols in these Confederate flags. You're seeing kind of references to certain, like, hate groups and certain kind of, like, militia, like, organizations, like 3%ers and stuff like that. It just kind of paints this picture of an area that is not necessarily the most welcoming. So I can see how that could be a very big barrier for Black and brown people to want to access those areas if they feel like they're potentially under threat. And those are the kind of things that I just kind of shared in that podcast episode.
Yeah, and Ray, actually, it's kind of funny because Brandon and I have never talked about this actually personally. We haven't had the opportunity, but it was really interesting because I would say, you know, sometime prior to the podcast, within weeks, I had some friends sitting around having dinner, and I was literally the person who was like, how's it different for anybody to go rock climbing? Like, the rocks don't care, the woods don't care, you know, it's an indifferent space. And of course, you know, a bunch of friends were throwing reasons at me and stuff like that. And I was like, ah. And then it was when I heard the podcast, I was like, it hit me like a ton of bricks because, you know, hearing it from my white friends, I was just kind of like, ah, you guys are just kind of taking a stance. But then hearing about driving through rural Georgia, like, I don't have that experience. Like, that's not the same experience for me. Like, if I break down, I can go knock on anybody's door with my southern accent and hoobity hoo and just be like, hey, y'all, I'm broke down. Like, oh, come in and get a biscuit, you know? And Brandon's not going to have the same experience. And that's like completely different. And it was just, it was completely eye-opening. Like, I've never felt more wrong about something after hearing that podcast than I did.
And this led to a partnership.
Technically not a partnership between Brandon and I, unless he's interested in guiding. When this came around, I work with a lot of outdoor brands. And there was a call to action right after the George Floyd killing for brands to speak up, for brands to do something, brands to be actionable. And there were so many brands that were making statements. They were doing stuff. Some brands were putting some money out there. But if you look at the amount of money they're putting out, it wasn't equitable to what the kind of money they have. And they're also just kind of just, you know, it's almost like hush money. You know, they're just like, oh, here's some dollars. Here's our post. Here's our thing. We did a social media post for a couple of days, but it's not actionable at all. And, you know, the business that we run, you know, we're like, what can we do? What can we do that is going to make a difference, right? Because we didn't do a social media post because that comes and goes. That's just a sparkler. That's going to flare up, get your pat on your back. You did something neat. You go on about your business. So we sat around, we studied, and it took me back to a time when I was on the Grand Teton, and there was a guide service that was local to the area, and they were guiding some Black kids from D.C. on the Grand Teton. And this guide was literally just dragging them around on the mountain. They were clearly a little uncomfortable because I don't know if they'd been in an alpine environment before. They were just being dragged around. The guide wasn't nice to them. It was like, this guy does not relate to these kids at all. He's just on a day of work. He's trying to get them up there for a photo opportunity. People through this period have tokenized Black people. And I just figured that the best way to empower the Black climbing community is to help use our company's funds to like help build a guide service that is Black ran, owned, and operated. Like, we don't want to set the direction. We don't want to give it a name. We don't want to do anything besides pay for somebody to get their guide certification and then see how we need to work together to get them gear, whether that's us helping provide that, helping crowdsource. The idea is for it to be Black owned and operated so that when Black kids are getting guided, they've got somebody that looks like them, that thinks like them, that knows what it feels like. Somebody that can stand up for them in an area that's rural and maybe not as welcoming, you know, as opposed to just some indifferent white dude trying to get a photo op for their Instagram page so they look diverse whenever they are posting about their brand or whatever.
And then how far along are you in creating this service?
I've gotten the preliminary structure written up. We've got the funds allocated. And so really, it's just to go live at the first of the year. We've always planned on doing this in the first quarter. COVID obviously has impacted our finances, but regardless of that, we still set aside the funds. And we're going to try to find someone to work with. You know, I mean, that's going to be the thing. At SBI, I joke and say it's like on par with a liberal arts degree on whether or not it's going to get used. So that's the single pitch instructor's certification. A lot of people think they want a guide. They get their SBI and they may never work a day. We don't want to just pay for an SPI. Like, we want to find somebody who wants to build a business, who wants to partner, who wants to like create a thing that's going to be sustainable that surpasses just giving somebody money to get a certification. While that could be helpful, we really want to help make sure that something gets fortified and is an actual program.
And Brandon, what input have you shared with Heath in helping to develop this idea and point him in the right direction as he looks for partners?
We've had a couple of conversations. Still trying to get in contact with a few folks who I know who have already been doing some level of guiding, either as like an independent business or just kind of more or less as a hobby. You know, the list is small. When you're talking about Black and brown people in general, I can maybe think of 10 people who've ever guided or who've ever even done like a multi-pitch like route. When it comes to just Black people, I can only think of like two or three. So it's mostly been just trying to see if we can find any sort of like partners for them or someone who can kind of get these things up and running. But yeah, just a couple of conversations, mostly preliminary stuff.
What kind of a timeline are we looking at here?
For most people, it depends on where you are as a climber. So as Brandon was stating, you know, there's a certain amount of skill set that comes to this, right? Like to be a guide is to have more knowledge than most people. So you're going to have to find a climber that has had experience in all the climbing disciplines that is going to be in a, like they may have a career that they don't want to leave, right? Like they maybe have a good job and they don't want to switch to guiding because I don't know if it's the most profitable thing until you get your book of business grown. This is going to be a bespoke program. We're going to build this program as it goes along. Really about creating a partnership. It's about whatever that takes. Even if we have a climber that comes in, they're very inspired to do this program, don't quite have the skill set yet. Well, then let's just go at, you know, we'll agree to work together. And while they get the skill sets dialed, while they put that time in, then we can get to that point through the course of the year. For me, it doesn't matter how quickly, there's no timeline. It's about the right person who really wants to see this happen. And it's a dream and a goal of theirs. And then for them to come to us, there's no real official way to put this together. Like, I think it's really going to be just like sitting down, as like we're having this conversation and building the program. My wife teases me. I don't think outside of the box. She says, I don't have a box. So to like actually say, well, this is what it's going to be. This is how it's going to be. Well, that's already me taking too much control of the program. I don't want to have control of the program. I want to facilitate the program. And I want the person who's going to run this program to run this program. And I also want to be there, you know, if they want my advice from having started a business myself and things along those ways, happy to be there, happy to be a partner in this. But I want whoever takes this program to own this program. And if that means it's going to take them a year to set it up, then it takes a year.
Brandon, the way Heath is talking here, how does this resemble other efforts that you may be aware of closer to where you live or in other parts of the country?
It's definitely really unique. I'll say when it comes to like what's going on in Atlanta or what's going on in most other like major cities, I would say that a lot of the efforts to try to empower like certain marginalized communities has been more kind of micro level, like grassroots. One thing that I've definitely noticed is that the food insecurity or food desert situation has become very desperate in a lot of cities like Houston, Atlanta, Chicago, New Orleans. Even prior to COVID, it was still a very bad situation. But now, you know, it's like one in four children aren't able to get consistent meals now on a daily basis. So when I think of certain efforts to try to empower marginalized communities, those are the sort of things that I immediately think of. You know, when it comes to what Heath is wanting to do, I say that it's unique because it's something that is very sustainable. And when I say empower certain people to kind of make a huge difference in their lives, I don't really take that lightly. Part of the issue that I've seen with a lot of these major corporate contributors, like part of the issue that I see with them getting involved in everything is that they only seem to really think of things in like a dollar amount or like money and cents. And so kind of like this like capitalist sort of mentality of like, okay, how do you solve a problem? You just throw a bunch of money at it. And you throw a bunch of money at it and you throw a bunch of money at it. Gear and money is great, but without some sort of like long-term sustained plan, or at least giving something to someone that they can utilize over and over again, like a certain skill set that they can employ themselves with and end up making a job or making money off of. I think that's something that's really impactful and is going to really make a big difference in some folks' lives instead of just like giving them a whole bunch of stuff and saying, okay, here's your stuff and the North Face or Adidas logo on it. And that's great. Stuff is great. Don't get me wrong, but long-term tangible skill sets that someone can use to make a little bit of money for themselves, I think is a really good thing to get started. And I wish that more of these corporate contributors were kind of thinking on that level. It's kind of that give a man a fish, teach a man the fish sort of mentality. It's great to do both. But unfortunately, I think a lot of these mainstream players are mostly just kind of giving the fish away.
Brandon couldn't have said it any better. I mean, there's just a lot of Band-Aids being thrown out in our scene, in the climbing world, right? And like Brandon pointed out, like there's a lot bigger things happening than climbing. Climbing is such a small, privileged thing that happens in life. Like that is a fact and hardcore fact. But yeah, I mean, I think the idea of creating a program, I mean, this will be the first kind of program like this in the Southeast. And I don't know about the rest of the country, but I'm not aware of anything else like this in the country. There's some groups that come together, but not necessarily in an official capacity. So like this has the ability to create experiences for people years and years and years and years down the road. This isn't just a one-time kind of thing to get your logo out there and say, look, we did something great, and then brush your hands.
And if people want to find out more about this, if they want to participate, if they want to help in any way, how can they contact you?
You can reach out to me directly. My email address is Heath, H-E-A-T-H, at groundupsales.net. Our website is groundupsales.net. Also, we'll have a page contributed just to this, so people can come in, check it out, see all the details, and contact information will be there as well.
All right. Heath? Brandon, thanks so much.
Thanks for y'all's time.
See ya.
A few years ago, Cecil Williams III of Chattanooga decided he wanted to live more despite his physical challenges. Back in 2003, he and a cousin were injured in a head-on collision, totaling his car and leaving him with a fractured right wrist. A year later, a doctor diagnosed Cecil with a nerve disease that would worsen over time, weakening his limbs and his motor skills, including his speech. He has endured losing a job and a permanent physical disability. But in 2018, he got a part-time job at the YMCA of Metropolitan Chattanooga. Cecil now experiences new activities outdoors through adaptive gear, sharing his story to inspire people. Back in the fall, I spoke with him about the adventures of Cecil. Cecil, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
Tell us more about the adventures of Cecil.
The adventures of Cecil is the journey that I'm on that I started back in 2018 to live more, to do more, to step outside of my comfort zone because I was in a car wreck hitting around midnight 2003. Then in 2004, I learned that I started to have a progressive nerve disease that progressed over the years. And I went from my FO to using a cane to now using a walker. I got disability in 2008. So between that 10-year period was the dark period of time in my life. 2018, I just turned 34, and I was like, there has to be more to life than this. I stepped my son on this, and I said, hey, I want to live. When I made that decision in my mind to just take life by the horn, that's when doors start opening.
And you've taken life by the horns outdoors with activity after activity up against what you're living with every day.
Yes, I deal with a disability called cerebellar ataxia. I've been introduced to adaptive sports that's modified for people with disabilities. And when I found it, it's like a whole new world opened up for me. I wasn't trying to find it, it found me. And I was like, you mean I can live again? First thing I tried was adaptive cycling. I was like, you know, those hand cycles were coming back. For the first time in my life, I was like, I found something that I love and enjoy. And I wanted to do everything that I could possibly do and find out about. I just learned about an organization here in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And then I started it. And learning about organization in Atlanta, North Carolina, Nashville, Knoxville. And some of the activities that I've been able to do is adaptive sailing, adaptive snowskiing, rock climbing. I just did adaptive mountain biking, scuba diving, and the swimming pool now, not in the deep waters, kayaking, And the list goes on and on. And there are programs out here that will help you continue to live. It helped me boost my self-esteem, my confidence, helped me be more sociable. And I'm like, through my breakthrough and through all my dark times that I've been through, I realized that, hey, I still have a story that I haven't told yet. And I tell my story by doing my adventures.
Which of your adventures has been the most challenging?
I love my heart. The one I love is the adaptive racing. And I started doing that and with the Cal Peace Foundation. It's the recovery bike. So I did a half marathon. I completed a half marathon, that 13.1 miles on the flat. Like one of my tires, two tires in the front and one the back flat. These are activities that I never done before. So I'm totally out of my element. Whether it's a different city, what have you, but I say right now I'm racing, adaptive racing.
And which of those activities has been the most fun?
I like meeting people. Meeting people that deal with different disabilities, and we out enjoying life. But I say so far, my best venture so far is adaptive mountain biking.
How come?
I love nature. And it's like, I used a walker to help me get around. So that means that I love hiking. I love seeing the beautiful nature, trees. And for me to get away from my walker and get on the adaptive mountain bike, and I can pedal through the forest, it's amazing. I'm just like everybody else. You go over trees, humps, you know, your little pothole. And it just, I went to Canton, Georgia to do an event with the Catalyst Watch. And I saw a deer in the woods. I was like, stop, take a picture. Y'all see that? You know, so it was like, I'm alive. I'm going to keep doing anything for as long as I possibly can.
And you are speaking to us from out in nature now. Where are you?
Tim Jordan Park. Hey, it matches the name, The Adventures of Caesar, right? So I'm always on an adventure.
Tell us more about what inspires you.
I've always been a motivator. I've always tried to encourage people. I just want to help people. That's just a big passion of mine. But what inspires me the most is life. You know, life is short. So why not make the best of it and have something to look forward to? Even if you're going through a little step back or whatever, go to the park, there's something that you can do to enjoy. I have a recovery bike. I like coming out to the park and I like riding around the trails. That's what makes me happy. And by doing that, I'm able to give that happiness that I have to others that I come in contact with.
I've read that your faith means a lot to you too.
Yes, sir. That's a big one. Faith in God is the key. I mean, whether or not you believe in God or higher power, I have to have faith to keep hoping, keep doing what I'm doing. I'm by myself, you know what I'm saying? So I'm like, I trust that God's going to give me, He's going to protect me. Just put myself out there. I think that's the scariest feeling in the world. Us as human beings, we like to control everything. The best thing about faith is putting your hope and trust in God, realizing that the outcome is not in your hands. It's scary, but it's rewarding. By me having faith, I've been able to do. I've been skydiving. The skydiving company in Jasper, Tennessee. And I was like, I see it. I visualized it and I say, I want to do it. I called them. What is it going to take for you to let me get that? And, you know, they said, just a doctor's note. I told my doctor, hey, this is what I want to do. Called people up same day. They said, come on. 14,000 feet later, in the air of airplane, just the adrenaline rush. It was like, if I can do this, I can do anything. There's a lot of stuff I want to do. I'm allowed to life, you know. I try to stay focused on one thing, but it's like when I see something else, I'm like, okay, I gotta do that, you know. But writing a book, becoming a professional motivational speaker.
Where can people go online to follow you and your adventures?
Instagram, The Adventures of Cecil. Facebook, The Adventures of Cecil.
All right. Cecil, thanks so much.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.